Well, as people are coming in, introduce myself. I'm Peter Payne. My wife and I started a nonprofit in 2008 called the Institute for Credible Christianity. We'd been with InterVarsity Christian Fellowship for a long time before that, back in Michigan. We moved out here to California to help my parents care for a younger brother that I have. But it didn't work out to stay with InterVarsity at that time, so we were trying to figure out what to do and decided to start this nonprofit. Part of it is overseeing a grad student fellowship at UC Santa Cruz. Part of it is traveling and speaking in Europe, which we began actually in the year 2000 when I was at our university with our grad faculty ministry at the University of Michigan. So we've been going back to Europe almost every year since then. This last spring was actually our 19th trip to Europe by invitation from the Christian student movements there. If you're interested, I have a few stapled together, but there's two pages that talk about our trip to Europe and the kind of things we did. We were in seven different countries with lots and lots of opportunities for interacting with students, and I love interacting with skeptics. Part of what I love about being in Europe is that people typically don't assume, of course, God doesn't exist. So you need to get to base, the very first base in terms of talking about God and challenging them and helping them think more seriously about the Christian faith and be attracted to it as a possible option. In fact, the time I think I enjoyed most this year was in Dresden, Germany. I gave back-to-back talks, both of which were aimed towards people who are complete naturalists, atheists, people who don't believe in any God and assume that that simply isn't true. So I just had a wonderful time interacting around two themes that connect quite well with people who assume that naturalism is true. In Lithuania and also in Sweden, I gave a talk which was entitled, Why Does God Want to Limit Our Sexuality? It's on the thing outside, Why Does God Want to Limit Our Sex Lives? Dave Byrne suggested, why don't you switch it to understanding the why of biblical sexuality? It's a little bit less in your face than why does God want to limit our sex lives. But when I'm speaking to a secular audience, having sort of blunt and bold out there, that works with them. And one of my convictions is that in trying to communicate not only with people who aren't Christians, but even, say, with our kids, or the question is, well, why do I have to wait until I'm married to have sex? Or why sex only within marriage? We can give them biblical arguments and say, this is what Scripture says, but there's so much pressure around them, look, it's perfectly normal, why not? It's very easy for them to succumb to the temptations. So I said, I think it's important for us to think about how do we explain, either to ourselves and others, why, in fact, the biblical ethic is not old-fashioned. Why don't I have us start off with a question you can discuss with someone near you. If someone said to you the following, how would you respond? The Christian sexual ethic of sex only in marriage is an ethic that used to make sense. It made sense because having sex entailed the serious possibility that the woman might get pregnant. And it's important that children be born into a setting where they will be wanted and cared for by the parents. But with effective birth control, the sex only in marriage ethic no longer makes sense. So turn to someone close to you. How would you respond to this? Okay, you probably keep going for a while, but what were some of your thoughts? Is the Christian sexual ethic of sex only within marriage, is that simply outdated? Done away with effective birth control these days.
It's not all about birth control.
It's not all about birth control. You want to elaborate a little bit?
So, just some research I have that when humans have sex with each other, a bonding process happens, very similar to the duck that's born will bond to whatever face it sees. Mm-hmm.
Right, right. Interesting enough, we seem we're biologically, biochemically wired. I'll come to that back in a second. That when we have sex, there's a commitment. And we're wired that way. Whether or not we want it, that's the way we are. Good. Anybody else? Yes. Right, so sex is not just a physical act. From a Christian standpoint, it has deep theological significance. As Paul says, it reflects our relationship with Christ. And that when you have sex with a person, you're not just having sex, but you are becoming one person with that. There's a spiritual connection which is taking place, and there's the connection between ourselves and God and how that's supposed to reflect God's relationship with us. Now, people who aren't Christians, that won't carry any weight. But for Christians, it ought to mean something.
When you eventually do get married, if you've had sexual partners before, it's going to be difficult not to compare your marriage partner with the other partners you've had before, and that can interfere with the marriage.
Yeah, so your wife wasn't quite as good as the person you had before. Actually, pornography is a major problem here. And the pornography, the actors and the people involved in it are people who are making it as sexually arousing as possible. And is my wife able to sort of put on the same show, or my husband able to put on the same show? So you have these memories, whether it's through the visual memories of pornography or if you had sex with other people, how does my wife compare? And if you haven't had sex with someone else, well, there's not a point of comparison. And you just, this is the way we are. And not every marriage starts off with sex working well. But the problems that people have sometimes with sex are not part of your deep-rooted personality. I mean, you can overcome the inhibitions and fears and anxieties that some people have when it comes to sex when they first get married. So some people say you need to be able to have sex together before you get married. You need to live together to actually know if it's going to work. Are we compatible? Well, if it's sexual compatibility, there's sometimes there's problems, but those can be overcome. And if it's sexual compatibility, well, you don't actually, you're pressing things in terms of actually getting to know whether this person is the right person. And statistically, it doesn't help. So cohabiting actually is a higher divorce rate than people who don't cohabitate but wait until they get married.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, or unless both people are past childbearing years, safe. Sometimes I think, Christians think, okay, we're older people, we can have sex now. So, there have been a couple people where I think, are they together in the wrong kind of way? I mean, they're Christians and they're accepted within the church, but I just kind of wonder about their relationship. But a person can say, well, there's no risk of having a baby here because, after all, the woman is no longer fertile, so therefore it's safe. Well, yes, it's safe that way, but is that all that's involved in marriage or the sexual relation? I would maintain, no, it's not. Yeah, and when people think about sexually transmitted diseases, it's not just AIDS. I mean, AIDS is the one that gets the most publicity, but there's the syphilis and all those kinds of things that have been around for a long time. So yeah, it's safer health-wise to have sex with just the one person, and if you are virgins before, then you're not transmitting diseases from other people. A person who's a cyclical person would say, well, okay, that just simply means to work on that. We need to do what we can to minimize those risks. So I need to be cautious, but those reasons will get less and less as time goes on, and we find better ways of preventing it or dealing with it when it arises. Okay, let me just say at this point that when it comes to sex and being sexually active, a group like this, my assumption would be that not all of you are married and having sex, and that some of you have had sex before you were married. Some of you may not be married, and you are currently in a sexual relationship with people. Increasingly, the percentage of Americans who do have sex, including Christians, apart from marriage, just keeps going up. And we need to have grace in that. I mean, people will oftentimes not talk about it, but there needs to be forgiveness and grace that goes with it. Jesus, in the story of the woman caught in adultery, now whether this is actually part of the original, most scholars think it was not part of the original Gospel of John, but it certainly fits with Jesus, what we know about him, that this woman is caught in adultery, and they're basically asking, shall we stone her? And Jesus doesn't debate that the law actually says that, but rather he says the one who is without sin cast the first stone. And they all realize that they have sin, and they walk away, and the woman is there with Jesus, and Jesus says to the woman, does no one condemn you? And she says, no. And Jesus replies, neither do I condemn you. From now on, sin no more. So Jesus isn't saying that what you did was right, but there's mercy, there's grace. And we need to show grace to people who haven't been holding to God's standard about sex only within marriage. And we need grace with our children, we need grace with relatives, we just need lots of grace that way. And when people have been engaged in sex, it's not as though their life, they've missed the boat. It's not simply between being a virgin and not being a virgin. So sometimes people feel, if I'm no longer a virgin, then I can go ahead and have sex, the damage is already done. Well, no. I mean, there's advantages of being a virgin. Both my wife and I were virgins when we got married. And that's not all that typical anymore, that actually both people are virgins when they get married, and there's value in that. But if you're not, there's still value in waiting. Let me insert here, I was thinking about saying it later on, is that suppose two people are engaged to get married, and they're Christians, and there's no doubt in their mind they're getting married, there's not sort of, well, some uncertainties, and they decide, well, why don't we start having sex together? And I know a fair number of Christian couples do that. I don't know what percentages are of Christian couples who have sex while they're engaged before they get married. But actually, it is of your benefit, and I'll give statistics that will help show this, is in your benefit to stop. Suppose the wedding is 2.5 months away. If you stop and do not have sex until the actual wedding night, again, that wedding night will be much more special to you. I mean, after all, you've had the discipline of waiting, and now, in fact, there's the specialness of it. Plus, the fact that you had the discipline to wait builds trust into the marriage relationship. So if the husband or wife has gone off on a business trip, and it's not uncommon for propositions to be made and for opportunities to have sex to be there, will the person, the spouse, resist? And if you knew amongst the two of you that you had the self-discipline to wait, even though you're having sex before, until you got married, that builds trust in the relationship. So even though there's effects of having sex before, there's significant healing which can take place. And God's grace can work in our lives. Again, it's not as though there's nothing that carries over from our past sins. But nonetheless, there's a great deal of healing that God can bring about in our lives. And people who are involved sexually and decide to wait, and wait until they get married, there's tremendous benefit in that. So I'll say more about that in just a little bit. Okay, biblical view of sex. I just wrote this short statement about sort of how I view sex from a biblical perspective. Sex is solely to be within the marital bond that unites a man and a woman in lifelong love. That brings them together into a complementary whole, a whole that reflects the union of Christ with his church, and that provides a setting within which children can be raised and receive the complementary nurturing of a father and mother. So just sort of brief statement of how I see the biblical view. Why? Why do we think that still holds? And I've given this talk in Sweden and elsewhere. I've given four non-religious reasons. So without your being Christian, not believing in God, no matter where you're coming from, there's four good reasons for why the idea of sex only within marriage actually makes sense. And the first one is oxytocin. I sometimes ask the question, what's wrong with sex just for the fun of it? And the one-word answer is oxytocin. Now, oxytocin is a hormone that's released in the brain. It's released not only in sex and the lead-up to sex, although it's released there in much larger quantities than elsewhere. But in any context of affection, a hug, oxytocin is a relief, sort of a feel-good hormone. It helps build a bond with the person that you're with. And was mentioned at the beginning, for people who have sex, that hormone is building a bond between the two people. Now, if two people just have a one-night stand for the fun of it, probably the oxytocin won't have that much effect. There's not that much bonding that takes place with sex, and then you're gone. But if you have sex several times with the same person, you may have wanted it just to be for the fun of it. But, in fact, you find that when you break it up, it hurts. You didn't think it was going to hurt, but it does. It hurts for the woman, typically more than for the man, because twice as much oxytocin gets released, but it hurts for the man as well. So for the man, the breakup, even though they want it just for the fun of it, is hard, and it's hard for the woman. So the idea that you can have it just for the fun of it is deceiving yourself. Your biochemistry actually goes against that, and you find that, no, it actually hurts. So having sex builds a bond, and when you break it off, there's consequences. Now, here's a definition of oxytocin from Psychology Today, their website under Psych Basics. What is oxytocin? Oxytocin is a powerful hormone. When we hug or kiss a loved one, oxytocin levels drive up. It also acts as a neurotransmitter in the brain. In fact, the hormone plays a huge role in pair bonding. Prairie voles, one of nature's most monogamous species, produces oxytocin in spades. This hormone is also greatly stimulated during sex, birth, breastfeeding, the list goes on. So it's well recognized within psychology that oxytocin is a powerful hormone and it's emotional bonding, creates emotional bonding. There's a movie I haven't seen, I'm not going to see it, don't think it's probably worth seeing, called Vanilla Sky, in which Tom Cruise is this playboy. And he has sex with a woman, after having sex, he dumps her. And she says to him, "Don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not?" Okay, so biologically, the way in which you're constituted, when you have sex with a person, the natural thing between the two of you is a bond. So biologically, sex is to be connected with commitment. And after all, for children raising, it's important that sex and commitment go together. And that when you have sex, actually, biologically, there's a commitment that's being made, even if you don't say it yourself. So your body is making a promise whether you do or not. It's a very interesting comment to come out in a secular movie. Okay, next non-religious reason is that there are two ideas in tension which are commonly held by the same people. The first is that sex for the fun of it before marriage is okay. And even if it's not sex just for the fun of it, it's sex with someone that you care about a lot and you like a lot. And you got to know sex is okay. So it's fine. And you have sex with a variety of people before you get married. So that's one idea. The second idea is that once you get married, you're supposed to have sex only with your husband or your wife. Now, most people still hold to both of those things. Most people eventually want to get married, and when they think about getting married, they think, once I get married, that's only with my husband, with my wife. But before then, it's okay for me to play around and have some fun, sow my wild oats. But at some point, I settle down and I become a good husband, a good wife. Well, when you get married, there's no switch in your brain that goes from being play around mode, now I'm in fidelity mode. Your brain doesn't go through that kind of a flip-flop. So what you're expecting is that somehow I was given to temptations before, but I won't give in to temptations afterwards. So there's actually a tension between these two ideas. If you act on the first one, it makes it more difficult to be faithful to the second one. Now, if you ask the question, what is more important in terms of your long-term well-being, your long-term self-interest? Is it to find a partner with whom you get married and spend the rest of your life and have it be a successful, good marriage? Or that for the years between when I'm sexually can have sex and when I get married, that I have the pleasure of sex with a variety of people? What's more important for your own personal well-being? Well, it's pretty obvious that the latter is much more important than the former. And if the former creates problems for the latter, you're not being wise when you go for the former because you're creating problems for your long-term well-being. So just in terms of self-interest, when you go for short-term gratification, you're actually acting against your long-term self-interest. And even from a secular atheist standpoint, that doesn't make sense. Now, people, when I've given this talk, and I give some studies that indicate, support this kind of a view, that waiting is good, I tell them that even if you agree with the things I'm saying, it's likely that you won't follow my advice. It's likely that you will find yourself with someone who both of you are sexually attracted to each other. You both would like to have sex. Your sex drive is going. And for neither of you, is it a sin, religious thing? So for you, likely you will go for it and you'll have sex. And likely your mind will convince you that, yes, it's okay. And if you happen to be rational enough, you actually remember Peter Payne's lecture on some of the statistics that I give. So those are just statistics. We are individuals. Not all individuals have the same problems that these statistics talk about. It's only commonly it happens. But we are mature people. We can handle this. In fact, in Sweden, I gave this talk. And a couple of the questions afterwards from those mostly non-Christians, and most of them, I assume, were having sex with their girlfriend or boyfriend. And a couple of the questions afterwards, well, the studies you mentioned were studies with Americans. What about cross-cultural studies? And I know in the back of their mind was, well, we're Swedes. We've been at this longer than you Americans have, and we can handle it. You know, sex is something which we're okay with. But actually, no, the studies would affect them, perhaps not in the same way as with Americans, but in the same direction. So there's two ideas which are in tension. Next, there's a strong societal need for strong controls on sex. Now, in most cultures, sex is legislated when you get married, you officially get married, there's a license that you sign, so the state's involved in it. But if you ask the question, why is it the state needs to be involved in intimate relationships with people? Now, from a Christian standpoint, we say there's a moral right and wrong, but apart from that, just thinking sort of sociologically, why should the state care what two adults do in a bedroom together? And I think that really there's no overriding sort of state interest in controlling what people do in the privacy of their own bedrooms in their home. But there's a strong state interest in what happens to children. So it's very important if the state is going to continue, society is going to continue to flourish and do well, that children grow up and be emotionally well-balanced and become good citizens. But to grow up and be emotionally well-balanced, they need to grow up in a setting where there's nurture and love. And the most important people for the nurture and love of children are their parents. And if you only have one parent, well, that parent can get by, and it sounds as though children raised in a single parent home can't grow up to be decent kids. Nonetheless, the ideal is that they have the input from both parents. Actually, from a father and mother. Why don't two fathers or two mothers? Well, there is something different about men and women, and a father is able to provide different input than what a mother provides. So there actually is benefit in their being raised in a home where there's a stable relationship. But that also means that there's going to be a stable relationship, those people need to be faithful to each other. If the husband or the wife is having sex with somebody else, again, oxytocin kicks in, there's a bond being developed elsewhere, that tends to undercut the marriage relationship, and that's bad news for the marriage. When the divorce takes place, that's bad for the kids. So society actually wants strong controls on sex for the sake of the effect on children, not necessarily for the sex in itself. So when I was in college, there was a book entitled Open Marriage, in which the husband and wife were arguing that we should be encourage people to consider the possibility of having open marriage, where the husband and wife can have sex with other people, and it could work out fine. A number of years later, these two people got divorced. That happens. Okay, so it's important that parents love each other and that the relationship be exclusive sexually and that it be long-term. That's important for the children. The negative personal impact of casual sex or sex before marriage, I'm going to look at some psychological studies, and the reason why these are important is reasons can be given why it's beneficial to wait. But you can say, okay, well, there's some reasons on that side, but the reason on the other side, so who's to decide what's the best course to take? But if, in fact, the studies indicate that if you have sex before marriage, your chances of having long-term happiness personally and in the relationship are diminished, then it's not wise. I mean, that's just, regardless of how one explains that, that's something you need to take seriously, and it's not just, well, there's reasons for and reasons against. I want to start off with a study in 2010, came out in the Journal of Family Psychology, reported in WebMD. So I'm quoting from WebMD here. The title of the WebMD article was Benefits in Delaying Sex Until Marriage. Happier Marriages, More Satisfying Sex Among the Perks, Study Finds. Interesting title for an article. So the report says the study involved 2,035 married participants with a spread demographically, Catholic, Protestants, non-religious, et cetera. The majority of the couples had sex within 2 months of starting to date. So a majority of people in this study, from the time they started dating, they'd had sex before 2 months was up. And I suspect that it's even higher today. That, well, dating, well, you don't necessarily go to bed. But that's something you think about if you start dating. And if you're boyfriend and girlfriend, well, you know, it's okay to have sex because you're boyfriend and girlfriend. So a majority, it's interesting to me, had sex. 16% of those they interviewed had delayed intercourse until marriage. According to the study, people who waited until marriage rated sexual quality 15% higher than people who had premarital sex. Related relationship stability is 22% higher. Related satisfaction with their relationships, 20% higher. Now, that's not huge, but that's significant. They also add that the benefits were about half as strong for couples who became sexually active later in their relationships, but before marriage. And I think they counted later in their relationship as later than 2 months. If you wait 6 months and start having sex, it's much better in terms of the negative effects than if you start having sex within the first couple months of dating someone. The study, this is a quoting still, the study shows that couples who wait until marriage are happier with the quality of sex than couples who have intercourse before their vows. What's more, couples who delay sex until their wedding night have more stable and happier marriages than couples who have premarital sex. And the author, quoting from the author of the study, regardless of religiosity, waiting helps the relationship form better communication processes, and these help improve long-term stability and relationship satisfaction. Now here the author of the study is giving a little interpretation. Why is it these statistics? And he's assuming, well, if they're not having sex together or they're waiting, they're actually the communication process is better. The bond that they're developing is a bond around common interests rather than a bond around sex and the hormones that would bond people together, and communication takes place. Even apart from having sex, when people are getting into, you know, cuddling and petting and, you know, all this sexual kind of arousal things together, they're typically not talking very deeply. Communication isn't very good. And if you get into that mode very often when you're together, that slows down, it hurts the development of a relationship. Plus, it gives sort of the signals, well, we feel close to each other, there's an emotional closeness, but how do I interpret this? Is this the right person? Well, it's being built around that emotional bond, which is being built, but not around the things that actually tell you, are we a good fit for each other? I ought to say that the professor in the study is a professor of Brigham Young's University School of Family Life. When I saw that, I thought, oh. If I were a non-Christian, really, suspect. Here's a person who is Mormon, at least I assume he's probably Mormon, not necessarily. And so he's, how do I know this study isn't sort of twisted to get the sort of outcome that he wanted? Well, studies that are done by somebody who has something, a bias in the study, doesn't mean the study is necessarily bad, but one does need to think about it. When I see studies done on homosexuality, and the authors of the study are very staunchly homosexual themselves, I ask, okay, have they tweaked it sort of to have it come out their way? But this study doesn't just stand by itself. There are other studies that back it up. So 2012, our Cornell University study, analyzing data from a 2006 marital and relationship survey, as reported in the Cornell Chronicle, the campus magazine in 2012. In the Cornell Chronicle, they write, women who have sex early in a relationship are more likely to be dissatisfied with the quality of the relationship. That's what came out of the study. Men who delayed sex also report higher levels of commitment and less conflict, but the effect was greater for women. Early sex in a relationship was also associated with living together sooner and less satisfying marriages. So again, this is another study, completely secular study, Cornell University, which backs up what the first study was saying. The lead author of this, Sharon Sassler, writes, regardless of its causes, sex early on in a relationship may have lasting effects on the quality of that relationship. There's another study I want to mention done by the University of Virginia in the National Marriage Project. The study was entitled Before I Do. What's interesting about this study is different than these two studies I mentioned before this. It was a longitudinal study. So they start off with a sample where they interview people, and then they come back later. In this case, it's coming back 5 years later and contact the very same people and see what has happened. So longitudinal means over time. And the study started off with unmarried couples who were in a sexual relationship. So they start off with people who already are having sex with each other. So it's not sort of having sex, not having sex. So the baseline is couples who are in a sexual relationship with each other but are not married. 5 years later, they came back to find out what happened. And there were about 1,200 people involved in this study, couples involved in this study. About a third of those had actually married the person that they were with 5 years ago. So one third married, two thirds didn't. So just because you're in a steady relationship with someone doesn't mean you're going to marry the person. But one out of three had gotten married. And then they interviewed and then drew data from those interviews. Quote, and this is describing the study. Between 2007 and 2008, 1,293 unmarried Americans who were in relationships and between the ages of 18 and 34 were recruited for the study. Through the next 5 years, 418 of them recruited individuals, of the recruited individuals were married, whom the researchers then studied. According to the study, men and women who had premarital sex with only the future spouse reported having a stronger relationship than those who did not. So they're in a sexual relationship, come back 5 years later, if they haven't had sex with anybody else but that one person, they have a stronger relationship than those who had sex with more than one person. Additionally, women who had fewer sexual partners prior to marriage reported having higher marriage quality. So this study was not looking at sort of having no sex versus sex, but if you have sex and it's only one person, that's much better than if you have sex with several people before you actually get married. So if these people were the same person that they married, but they had sex with other people in addition to that, the prospects for their marriage are worse with the multiple sexual partners that they've had. They also wrote the order in which couples move through relationship stages, such as cohabitation or having children, can also impact marriage success. According to the study, those who unintentionally cross these relationship milestones have lower marriage quality than couples who decide on their relationship sequence together. Now, most people, when they decide to live together, it's actually a decision. But most young people who decide to live together, they haven't sort of decided, well, this is means we're really committed to each other. Some people will move in together and say, well, let's live together for a while, and that'll help us know whether we should get married. So marriage is a serious possibility. Let's live together for a while. I think there are probably more people who fit in that than was the case before. But at the same time, they're living together. There's no public commitment that's being made. And in most instances, whether or not they're going to get married, well, we'll just kind of wait and see. We don't know about that. So the argument then becomes, well, if we cohabitate, then we'll know whether we're sexually compatible. I was reading a study, a significant number of people who cohabitate together at some point become not quite as careful as they should. And a significant percentage, I think it's about 30% of people cohabiting together over the period of time of cohabitation, so the woman gets pregnant. Now, you can either go through abortion or you have a child outside of marriage and you've got problems. So when you're doing things, you're not thinking about the consequences. You're deciding to live together, but does this mean that we're seriously thinking about marriage? No, we just sort of slip into it. Or, well, okay, so I'm pregnant. What do we do now? That kind of thing. The prospects for the long-term relationships are worse. I was reading a recent study. A number of studies have indicated that people who live together have a significantly higher divorce rate than people who don't. So even though you think, well, if we live together for a while, then get married, we'll know whether it's going to work and divorce rate be lower, actually, people who live together have a higher divorce rate than people who don't live together. This more recent study was a study by asking, well, when do people start cohabiting together? If they wait until after age 23, it seems as though the divorce rate isn't nearly as high. It's about 30%. If people get co-live together before that time, say 18 to 20 around there, the divorce rate is 60%. So older people when they're living together are more likely to have to work things out. But again, it's a matter of taking the relationship seriously, and if people aren't taking it seriously, then there's problems that result from us. But either way, the thinking that it's your advantage to live together to find out if marriage will work and it'll help reduce divorce rate actually doesn't reduce it. And when it's people living together and they're fairly young, that's particularly bad. It's kind of like the relationship earlier or later, depending on when the cohabitation starts, the effects are worse or less worse or more worse or worser. Not as good. Okay, there's a study that was done, a book that's written called Premarital Sex in America by Mark Regeneres and Jeremy Euchre. And what they did, this came out in 2011, and they looked at studies which had been done up to that point and summarized what they found about the practices of American teenagers and people before the age, they're looking at people from age 15 to 25 was the age span that they were looking for. So when we look at these national studies, there's a big national study that did between 15 and 44, but they were looking at just at 15 to 25. The New York Times, reporting on it, wrote, their research, which looks at sexual behavior among contemporary young adults, finds a significant correlation between sexual restraint and emotional well-being, between monogamy and happiness, and between promiscuity and depression. This correlation is much stronger for women than for men. Female emotional well-being seems to be tightly bound to sexual stability, which may help explain why overall female happiness has actually drifted downwards since the sexual revolution. I haven't gotten in the book to see where he talks about that, but there are a number of ways women's position has actually improved significantly since the 1960s is when people usually count the beginning of the sexual revolution. So job prospects, pay, those kinds of things, many ways women's position have improved. But if these studies are right, the level of sort of perceived happiness is actually lower now than it was when they didn't have those before. Among the young people, quote, going back to the quote, among the young people Regeneres and Euchre studied, the happiest women were those with a current sexual partner and only one or two partners in their lifetime. Virgins were almost as happy, though not quite. And then a young woman's likelihood of depression rose steadily as her number of partners climbed and the present stability of her sex life diminished. It's interesting to me that they say that women who never got married, okay, remained single, were virgins, didn't rate quite as high a degree of happiness as married women, successfully married women, but nonetheless not too far behind. What that tells me is that your level of happiness doesn't primarily depend on whether you're married or not. And it doesn't primarily depend on whether you're sexually involved with another person. I mean, those can be added benefits. But your basic happiness is much more related to the relationships you have, the way you relate to other people, the sense of satisfaction you have in what you do and the things you're able to accomplish, the way you're able to serve other people. Those relational things are far more important in terms of your own level of personal happiness than the sexual life which we happen to have. Okay, what the studies tell us. One, waiting until marriage is not an old-fashioned idea based on the danger of unwanted pregnancy. Two, opting for short-term pleasure now is likely to have a negative effect on long-term happiness for oneself and for the couple. And even if one eventually marries the sexual partner, the premarital sex can have negative effect on the marriage relationship. Benefits. These studies don't actually say why there are these differences, but here are some that are at least plausible. One, physical expressions of affection and love can express the growing love and commitment. So when you're communicating to another person, there's both verbal communication and physical communication. You can verbally say, I love you, and you can act in ways which communicate your love for the other person. If, in fact, your expressions of physical affection reflect your degree or level of commitment or how you're feeling about the other person, then that's actually communicating. If you're out with a girlfriend and you're holding hands, I mean, that's not erotic kind of thing, but nonetheless, it's physical communication. We're boyfriend and girlfriend. People can see us. We're holding hands together walking down the sidewalk. Okay, so the physical communication, the physical act communicates something to the person. If you wait until you get married before you have sex, then the sexual act itself communicates, I am now committed to you. We are husband and wife. You and only you are the one in my life. So it communicates that. If you had sex earlier on just for the fun of it or casual, you didn't have much commitment, then it doesn't communicate anything. So the power of communication through physical affection, it gets lost. Having sex just simply means, well, you're a boyfriend and girlfriend. It doesn't really communicate what's important. Next, physical expressions of affection, not just sex, can push a relationship too fast. So this emotional bond is developing through the affection that they're having with each other, and if they're having sex with each other, there's an emotional bond which is developing that way. But does that actually reflect their thinking about, do we want to get married? Should we get married? When I was dating Janet, we were cuddling with each other, and physically things were pushing faster than I wanted to go because I wasn't sure I wanted to get married at all. But I was communicating, sort of we have this growing relationship, and I asked her, am I communicating to her that things are going along this relationship and we'll see where it goes? But if I do not want to get married, then I shouldn't be sort of pressing those buttons that are communicating that. So in our situation, we decide, okay, let's draw some lines here. And when I do this, it'll mean this. And when I do this, it'll mean that. And everybody could come up with their own answers that way. But the physical part of it can push a relationship. And oftentimes, if a woman gets pregnant, that becomes a reason why they get married. Or if they're living together, well, we're living together, we should get married. And they're oftentimes living together not because, well, this is the person I want to spend the rest of my life with, but I've been doing this for several years now. What do? Well, get married. So it pushes the relationship faster than actually what's going on relationally in other ways. Healthy relationship needs lots of communication. I mentioned earlier that when people are in a physical relationship, they're not able to talk as much. If a relationship can be simply friends together, sharing facts, activities together. One of the problems with the concept of dating is that when you're dating someone, well, that's a special relationship. You're now boyfriend-girlfriend, and boyfriend and girlfriend are supposed to be physically affectionate with each other. Well, what about the getting to know each other where you're just friends, and you're doing things together, and it's not physical? I mean, there ought to be some way of being able to do that where it's not under the label of dating, or you're identified as boyfriend and girlfriend. Of course, resisting future temptations when one is married is easier if one has had the self-discipline to not have sex before, or if one has had sex and one has the discipline to stop, and from there on out to have that discipline, that helps you in your future marriage relationship. The trust between husband and wife is thereby enhanced. Here's a quote from Lauren Winner, a book entitled Real Sex, The Naked Truth About Chastity. Life lived inside the contours of God's law humanizes us and makes us beautiful. It makes us creatures living well in the created order. It gives us the opportunity to become who we are meant to be. Now, if we can convince young people, I mean, if you're my age, we have grandchildren, but you have say, teenagers or people who are, you know, wrestling with what am I going to do with the sexual desires that I have, and should I wait, why should I wait? If they come to the conviction that actually waiting humanizes them, it makes life beautiful. It makes us creatures living well within God's created order. And when they see their friends not going that route, and there's a huge amount of fallout and disaster and hurt that's going around, they can actually communicate to their friends, what you're doing is foolish. Much better is the path that I'm on. Look at what happens if you do this. And if they can see it and model in parents and other adults and be able to say, this is what some of the benefits can be of living this way. This is what I want for myself. And God's law isn't just simply an arbitrary command to make see whether we're going to be obedient around an issue which is difficult, namely sex. Actually, God's command are given to us for our flourishing. And if we can help our children and others around us to come to the conviction that, yes, in fact, that is the path, or if one is sexually involved, be able to say, I can get off that path and get back on God's path, there's great benefit in doing that. I want to say a couple things about identity. There's a question, what place does sexuality or engaging in sex have or should it have in our own personal identity? So I'm a man. Some of you are women. How much is that crucial to your identity? Well, it's obviously a significant part of who you are. It colors who you are. But is your identity principally around that? I mean, if your identity is around your sexual drives and feelings, what happens for one out of four men who are sexually deficient, okay, having problems with it, the ads? Are they less human? Do they have less identity? Is there less worth because now they no longer have the strong sexual drive that they had before? If they think that, oh, I pity them. I mean, they have a really warped view of themselves. To think that my identity and worth as a person depends upon the strength of my sex drive or being able to act upon it, no, that's not the case. But nonetheless, it's a common assumption today that your sexuality and engaging in sex is so much a part of who you are that not to act on it is to deny who you are and to live less than a fully realized life. So if you tell someone who is not married and may never get married, well, you need to be celibate. From the secular standpoint, you're denying the person's identity, who they are. Their very being is diminished because they're not able to act on who they really are. But that's actually a warped view of who we are. True, there's my being a parent, having children. Those are all part of my identity, but my identity is not principally in being a parent, as important that is. My identity is in Christ, and my identity is who I am as a human being with the image of God and in relationship with other human beings. So as significant as gender is in who you are, your identity ought not to be in being a lie in being a person, a human being, and loved by God. As good as sex is in its proper place, being sexually active ought not to be a fundamental part of one's identity. Put another way, living a rich and fulfilling life does not depend on being on engaging in sex. So whether or not you engage in sex, engaging in sex can be an important part of a bond or a relationship with someone. Obviously, sex, there's pleasure involved in sex. But if you don't have that, it's like you don't have to have the icing on the cake. We eat too much sugar, I eat too much sugar. Well, if I drop the sugar, would I be missing out? Well, it's true, there is something that I like that I wouldn't have, but my life wouldn't be diminished. And to think if one lives by God's biblical standards that somehow one's life is diminished and one is not denying something fundamental about your identity, that's a mistake. There's a quote I like from Dorothy Sayers, who wrote a number of detective stories, but she also wrote other books. This is a short little book called Are Women Human? Quote, a man once asked me how I managed in my books to write such natural conversation between men when they were by themselves. Was I, by any chance, a member of a large mixed family with a lot of male friends? I replied, on the contrary. I was an only child and had practically never seen or spoken to any men of my own age till I was about 25. Well, said the man, I shouldn't have expected a woman, meaning me, to have been able to make it so convincing. I replied that I had coped with this difficult problem by making men talk as far as possible like ordinary human beings. This aspect of the matter seemed to surprise the other speaker. He said no more, but took it away to chew it over. One of these days, it may quite likely occur to him that women, as well as men, when left to themselves, talk very much like human beings also. Okay? So as much as being a man is part of who I am, and if you're a woman, being a woman is part of who you are, that's not essential in terms of your basic identity. Your basic identity is a human being. And the things that we desire, relationship with trust, communication, sharing, those kinds of things are much more fundamental to us. And our relationship with God is fundamental. So a person who has, this talk isn't about homosexuality or about sort of all these mixtures of sexual orientation, etc. If your sexual orientation is not the way the biblical standard says you ought to be, you ought to be acting in that kind of way, your identity is not fundamentally in that. Maybe I sent out to you a clip that was on the YouTube of a Christian clergyman in the Anglican Church in the UK. And he was speaking to an assembly of Anglican clergy. It's all clergymen in this room. And he said before them that he was homosexual in orientation, that ever since he was quite young, his sexual desires have always been towards members of the same sex. But he's decided that it's not faithful to God's word to stay with that, but that he's done that. And he says, I feel well supported by my church, but I don't feel well supported by you, my fellow clergy. Even though they recently passed a statement which still says sex of marriage is between a man and a woman, the Anglican Church had passed that, there are a lot of dissenters. And he said, many of you, even though you passed that, treat me with contempt because I've decided not to be sexually active as a homosexual man. And he says, I thank God that my identity is not in my sexual orientation. My identity is in Christ. And if you think your identity is in your sexual orientation, being sexually active, then Jesus could not have been fully human or fully, he wasn't really fulfilling his life. Because after all, not being married and not engaging in sex, well, he can't be a model for us. But no, if he is the model for us and his life is the model of rich and full life, then we can take heart saying that our identity, our sexual identity, what we do sexually is not part of the essential core of who I am. And he said, I thank God that my identity does not rest fundamentally in the sexual orientation that I have. And it should work the other way if you have a heterosexual orientation. Your identity shouldn't fundamentally rest in that, but in the fact that you're created by God, in the image of God, you're a human being who's loved by God. A conclusion here. When one gives in the pleasure of short-term sexual gratification, apart from long-term commitment, one is acting contrary to one's long-term well-being and contrary to the long-term well-being of the relationship of the couple. Recognizing this may not be enough to withstand the temptation of the moment. The human mind is quite readily justifies to itself any action towards which there is strong motivation. Lesson, be warned, when sexual attraction is in high gear, one's moral deliberations ought not to be trusted. I was talking to a high school student here of a few years back here at Mount Hermon, and he was sleeping with his girlfriend. And he thought he was being very objective about this whole thing. And so if you're sleeping with your girlfriend, you cannot be objective about that relationship. Your brain is actually doing things in your mind, which just the fact that you're doing it, enjoy it. You want to justify it to yourself. Your brain is going to rationalize what you want, and particularly when a sexual drives, your brain is going to want to justify that. So don't think you're thinking objectively. You're not. Wait to decide, well, what do I do right now? Probably you'll cave in because your brain will tell you, well, it must be okay. That's what I want. You need to come into ahead of time with the conviction, no, I won't do this, and you need lots of support. It's not easy these days. And because it's not easy, there's need for grace. We need to have a great deal of grace as Christians. If you have a son or a daughter who's sexually involved with someone else, you need grace in relation relating to them. We need grace in counseling a person, not sort of just condemning them for what they're doing, but with an empathetic ear say, no, that's not what you should be doing. That we need to turn to God's standards and actually our lives will be richer if we do so. A couple of books to look at. Real Sex, the one I quoted by Lauren Winter, There's a couple books by a Jewish author, not a Christian, a Jewish author, A Return to Modesty, Recovering the Lost Virtue, and a more recent book, The Good Girl Revolution, Young Rebels with Self-Esteem and High Standards. Part of what I like about this book is that she writes with the boldness of a feminist. I mean, she just has no wimp, and she grew up in a family where she could do anything she wanted to, and her father basically said, "I believe in you, you can do whatever you want," and she believes she can do whatever she wants. So she's obviously a very strong woman, but who came to the conviction in college that women who are giving in to the requests of men to have sex were actually betraying who they are. And that modesty, virginity, the modesty in sex is actually, if you act according to that, you're fulfilling yourself as a woman. It's actually fulfilling yourself as a man too, although she's writing from a woman's perspective, and it's refreshing to me to have someone who is who's articulate in talking about the values of a sexual view, a biblical view of sexuality. So let me stop at that and just ask for questions. Take a few minutes, then we'll break for lunch. Well, let me mention there's a clipboard back here. If you'd like to get the PowerPoint, go ahead and put your name and your email address on that. When you do that, I'll also give you updates on things that ministry-wise I'm doing. If you don't want to be on that, let me know, or if you start getting it and you want to be off of it, just you can email back and say delete, and I'll take you off the list. There's also out there some report, the two-page report that my wife and I did for a two-month trip to Europe, actually almost 10-week trip to Europe that we did this last spring. I mentioned at the beginning. Questions, though? So your kids are thinking about living with a boyfriend or girlfriend, or?
My son, I'm a single mom, I'm a Christian. His dad is living with another woman.
Okay.
Child together. How do I not bash his father or seem judgmental or putting that down, but he's still in him?
Yeah, my advice is lift up the value of a Christian view of sexuality. You don't have to bash. Just lifting up the value and recognizing what these studies say. So you go to some of these studies and say, even from secular studies, the people who wait in having sex are better off than the people who have sex early on. The people who wait till they get married are best off. The people who start living together before they have that commitment have a higher rate of divorce than people who wait until they get married. So you can point to those kinds of things, but bashing is not going to help very much. And they'll say, why does he do that? Well, you can say, well, that's not what I agree with, and I encourage you to consider what is the better route to take. There's a book that came out in the UK called A Better Story. It goes God, Sex, and Fulfillment. And I love the title. I've got a little ways in the book, but I love the title because we do have a better story. It's a better story. It's good news for us. And I think that there's a tremendous potential in evangelism for talking about sexuality because there's so much brokenness there, and people can be attracted to the Christian faith by looking at what Scripture and Christ say about sexuality. Maybe one more question, and I know people need to take off.
I've got one for you.
Yeah. Well, if you know there's going to be sex ed classes in your school, do it before that. You don't wait till afterwards. And your kids will be getting it, and particularly if they have smartphones, they'll get it quite readily on the internet. So you could just at some point ask them, what have you been learning and reading about how babies come to be? When it's earlier on, well, the baby's growing in mommy's tummy. Okay, well, that's good for, babies grow in mommy's tummy. They don't come from the stork. How does that come about? You can wait until they start asking, but you can ask them questions about what they've heard and what they know. And typically, you'll be surprised they know more than you thought they knew, because they hear these things quite early. But yeah, it's important to talk about it, and to talk about it is, you know, ask questions. And don't talk about super early, but if when they're getting close to puberty, you know, 13 thereabouts or moving up that way, yeah, you should talk about it. It's much better for parents to talk about it, but oftentimes parents don't talk about it. And the only information they get about it is from their peers and other contexts.
One of our gynecologists in a small town in the foothills went to his daughter's junior high graduate, middle school graduation. Five of the young ladies walking the stage had already had children. So that's how early you have to go.
Yeah.
That was the eighth grade graduation.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there are a number of good books. I mentioned a couple of them here, but that'd be for an older person rather than for a younger person. I'm not sure for the younger person what the good book is, but ask around. I'm sure there's good things out there that can help them with it. Let me pray for us. Lord, I pray that you would give us grace in this difficult topic. And we are indeed in a sexual revolution where the idea of living together without being married, if you're 18, that's okay. A majority of Americans now think that is okay. But Lord, help us in a context where our society no longer stands with the what you desire for sex within our lives. Help us in, as we are parents or dealing with other people and talking about these issues. Lord, give us grace. At the same time, give us a commitment to stand by what you have. And Lord, help us have told us, and help us to be wise in communicating this, the wisdom of what you've given to us, that in fact, when we follow you, our lives can flourish. Amen.